Okay. A lot of you were here at the last session, and again, thank you for staying with me. It's quite flattering to have you in the audience, and I really appreciate your support, and I apologize about going a couple minutes over. I really wanted you to see Gizmo and Ginger because they are just outstanding cases, and just one of those things I had to go. So I apologize for that, and hopefully it didn't set you off too far. But thank you again for being here, and again, please thank the nice folks at Mariel for sponsoring my presentations. The last two presentations that I've done for you are nothing all that creative. I mean, it's stuff that's in the books. It's just a matter of kind of pulling the material from there and citing references and this, how many cases of this and that. This particular topic is of interest to me, but I need to preface everything and tell you, this is all me, okay? This is all my clinical bias in a nutshell. There is not a single publication anywhere on feline otitis. I've tried to write them. They get rejected because there's no references. Well, if there's no papers and no references, where the hell do we start? Okay? So I am going to share with you some very, very profound clinical biases. I will tell you point blank that many of my colleagues that I love and respect totally disagree with me. I will tell you my thoughts and opinions, and I want you folks to make your own decisions, okay? So I'm just trying to bring you all to the dark side and see if you see things the way I do. And hopefully you won't say, gosh, that Kenneth is just an arrogant whatever. Somebody's got to say it. So that's going to be me. What we're going to do this morning here is we're going to talk about some of the clinical findings, again, focusing on differential diagnoses, because if you could figure out the true cause of the problem, you're going to solve the problem. And that's really what our goal and objective is going to be. And then we're going to talk about treatments. Of all the things about treatments, where I deviate most from my colleagues, I do not use topical otic medications in cats, period. Absolutely stopped using them. I got tired of sloughing cat pinnas with Tresiderm. I got tired of seeing contact reactions with Conifite lotion. I do not put anything into a cat's ear. At the best, it's going to be sterile saline, and only when I need to do that for cleaning and flushing. Okay? That's where we draw the line right there, and my bias. This is Kashka. Kashka was euthanized, unfortunately, related to this, and we're going to talk about her a little bit more. But hopefully you can appreciate that she has anisocoria, and she has Horner syndrome. You can see a little bit of a droopy lip and a third eyelid here, and we're going to be looking at this lovely ear later on CT. This is a picture from Dr. Terry Fossum's surgical textbook. It's a very nice picture depicting the cat pinna. And in general, when we talk about feline otitis, the word otitis means inflammation, but it's inflammation of the ear canal and or the pinna. So the pemphigus cases that we see affecting the pinna, by definition, are otitis. It's still an inflammatory, albeit autoimmune, process affecting the ear. In general, when we talk about otitis externa, we are talking about everything from the tympanic membrane outward. So where the tympanic membrane stops, we now have the tympanic bulla. And when we have the bulla involved, we have what is referred to as otitis media. What's interesting about the cat is that the cat will frequently develop otitis media without overt otitis externa. So these cats may present with very subtle signs of pruritus of the ears, maybe a head tilt, and they have otitis media, but when you look in the ear canal, you don't see any abnormalities. The ear canal is fine. In most cases with dogs, what we tend to have is otitis externa, and with chronicity, kind of blows out the tympanic membrane, and everything kind of spills into the middle ear. But with the cats, we do tend to see a lot of middle ear disease all by itself. The term otitis interna is reserved for neurologic disease. And we can see that in cats. It doesn't occur very often. So in general, we break down into the categories that Dr. John August developed many, many years ago, looking at dog ear disease as a multifactorial problem. The same approach applies to our cats, except for the differential diagnoses are very different for the cat versus the dog. We have predisposing factors, things that would allow for an inflammatory process to occur. We also have primary factors. These are the things that all by themselves cause otitis. And we're going to run through a big long list of them, parasites top of the list. And then we have the perpetuating factors. The perpetuating factors in dogs and cats are the infections, the bacteria and yeast infections that occur. They're not primary, they are perpetuating. So just getting rid of the infection has not resolved the problem. It's still your job to figure out why the problem occurred in the first place, looking for that primary factor all the time. Our predisposing factors can include ear conformation. We think of the Shar Pei as being notorious for having stenotic ear canals. Cats in general have pretty darn healthy canals. So we don't tend to see that congenital defect, that congenital stenosis. It could occur. One of the questions that came up is that Scottish Folds, because of their abnormality and the way their ears are folded, are they more at risk for ear disease than other cats? And the answer is no. So it goes way beyond only conformation. Again, the conformation is going to be a predisposing factor, something that could prime the pump for otitis to occur. Moisture. We don't tend to worry too much about cats and moisture. In Texas, Alabama, it's all about the dog sitting in the ponds all summer long trying to stay cool. We get water in the ears, we get tissue maceration, and they develop infections. But there's no cat that ever is going to sit in a pond all summer long. That doesn't happen. Cats are great at grooming their ears. They're constantly doing this. So we don't tend to have moisture as a risk factor. The biggest risk factor in cats as a predisposing factor is iatrogenic trauma. And I will contend that the simple process of putting a cotton tip applicator, a Q-tip, into the cat's ear of a normal, healthy cat is enough to induce enough inflammation that you will make that cat develop a secondary infection and otitis. A simple cotton swab. And I've seen it a bunch of times. The history comes in, the client takes their cat to the vet, they see a little bit of debris, they stick a swab down there, and everything goes downhill from there because they find a couple of yeast, and then they put the Tresiderm in the ear, and the cat doesn't like it, and then the infection gets worse, and we get a yeast infection, and then we get a drug eruption. And then they come to see me, and the simple answer is, where did it all begin? Well, it began when somebody put that swab into the cat's ear. Otoscopic exam of a cat. I will tell you that in private practice, every puppy that walked through the door got an otoscopic exam. It was part of the physical. It got me good at doing an otoscopic exam. If you could do a puppy and see that tympanum, you could do anything. Okay? So I became an expert. I do not do routine otoscopic exams on cats unless I absolutely have to and am looking for a reason. Looking for a foreign body, a polyp, a lesion, an ulcer. Routinely, I'm not going to look at otoscopy in cats. I think it's a big mistake because, again, that cone going down those ears. Next time you go back to work, grab one of those otoscopic cones. It's probably 20 years old, still sitting in the drawer, and just feel it. There's going to be all kinds of little cuts and scratches in there. And think about that going into an ear canal and the trauma that it may induce. If you've got old otoscope cones, throw them out, get some new ones. They're not that expensive. And, oh, by the way, always order enough so that you could keep one, at least one of each size, sterilized. Because if you do have to perform a meningotomy, you need a sterile cone, and you don't want to have to wait a whole day to have an otoscopic procedure. We're going to talk about meningotomy in a couple minutes, but going back to this, okay? I see a dog walk through the door, chief complaint of otitis, I smell the ear, if it stinks, I stick a swab in it. If it's a cat, I do not. My bias, my explanation, you tell me what you think. Of the primary factors, foreign body is one of the most common. These are foxtails. They tend to be a problem out west. We had them in West Texas and further west from there. But any kind of plant on, grass material, foreign body, very common, especially in outdoor cats. Okay, they're running through the brush and shrubs and they can get a foreign body. foreign body in a cat is almost always going to be unilateral. It could be bilateral, but most of the time it's going to be unilateral. The parasites are the biggies. Otodectes, notoedries, top of the list, one of the most common things, common causes of otitis in cats. Otodectes and notoedries, easy to find, easy to diagnose, no big deal. Fly bite almost never occurs in cats, but I have seen mosquito hypersensitivity reactions in cats. And when you think about where a mosquito can feed on a cat, basically it's the bridge of the nose, the ears, and the foot pads. The rest of the cat is so dense with hair, it's very hard for a mosquito to feed. So we tend to see lesions in those areas. And when cats develop mosquito hypersensitivity reaction, it's the foot pads, the nose, and the ears usually. Ticks, pretty uncommon in cats. We occasionally see them, but they're fairly uncommon. I guess just trying to figure out why that may be, it may just be the grooming pattern of cats, that they groom the ticks off before the ticks actually have a chance to attach and persist. That's just a theory. Nobody really knows for sure, but we don't see ticks in cats very often. And then, of course, our allergic causes, atopy, food allergy, etc. Just a couple of quick pictures. I guess you all know that these are parasites, and this is a cat with notoedries and intensely pruritic. But I want you to pay attention to these lesions here, okay? Look at these beautiful shaped lesions. Did the cat make these lesions? Could the cat make these lesions? No, there's no way in hell, okay? Look at the shape of these lesions. Just looking at the shape tells you that there is something in the body, an inside disease process progressing outward. Now, this cat might be pruritic, but the cat did not make the lesions. And again, just knowing that point is going to change your differential diagnoses. These particular lesions on this cat were eosinophilic granulomas. Very bizarre. Weird location. This was a flea allergic cat. The cat's entire ventrum was covered with eosinophilic plaques, loaded with fleas. It was just a disaster. So I saw these lesions, and I was wondering if we had a drug eruption or what the heck was going on, and we did cytology, and they were just loaded with eosinophils, no bacteria. Never seen anything like it. But again, the cat did not make the lesions. Okay. Now, if the cat didn't have all that other stuff, the first thing I would do with this cat is impression cytology. Why? Pemphigus would be high on the list. Also a drug eruption, and now you know eosinophilic plaques as well, granulomas. Some of our other things that we may see, autoimmune pemphigus, we beat that one to death the last hour. Neoplasia does occur in a cat. In general, neoplasia in a cat ear is bad news. They tend to be very, very bad prognosis. We could have squamous cell carcinoma, apocrine gland, or sebaceous gland. They tend to be adenocarcinomas. We're going to take a close-up picture of this in just a second here. This is a slide that Dr. Alice Wolf gave me, and this is what she refers to as little blue balls. Little blue balls because they look like little blue balls. They can cause enough trauma in the ear to cause total occlusion and stenosis of that ear canal. In general, when you see these, I need for you to do a biopsy because I cannot tell if these little blue balls are neoplastic and benign or neoplastic and evil. Okay? So the whole reason for doing it, they are neoplastic. They may be cyst lesions as well, apocrine cyst, or they can be neoplastic. And you really need to know because it's going to change our prognosis. Also, if it's only one side and is neoplastic, maybe it's time to do radical surgery and it may be corrective. So we'll do a close-up of these little blue balls in a second. But in general, when you take a needle and you poke into them, it's kind of like dried blood, kind of like a blood blister of your own skin when you rupture them. And again, you can't tell just by looking. You really need to do a biopsy. And during the break, somebody came up and we're talking about what was referred to as a shave biopsy. It's a very common procedure in human dermatology is to just kind of shave the lesion with a little curette. It's like a little hook and you just scrape the surface. And you could do that. You could take a small curette and just kind of scrape off some of this stuff And here they were external enough where it would be a little bit easier to collect, but sometimes they're way down into the ear canal and you have to be more aggressive with your surgery. Clearly, ringworm dermatophyte on your differentials. Here's a close-up of the little blue balls. And one of the things I hope you'll appreciate is that we also have a little bit more earwax than we'd normally see in a healthy cat. And I think it's kind of hiding in the cracks and crevices of these little blue balls. So here's one up here as well. So you could take your 3-millimeter punch and you could take this one. You could take from over here. You could do a shave biopsy here. You have a whole lot of options. These little blue balls by themselves, if they are a cystic lesion, they're of no consequence except that they do tend to be progressive. And because now we've got this progressive lesion, you can have occlusion leading to secondary infection. Okay, so we may have a stenosis occurring as a result of these lesions. But in general, most cats leave them alone. Some cats come in through the door and they are miserable. Head shaking, scratching, all facial traumatic from doing this all the time. So they can be quite uncomfortable for the cat. Dermatophyte. We looked at this picture earlier of the wire-haired cat in the black gunk doing your cytology. Again, I would do a cytology here, but I'm not going to stick that swab all the way down the ear canal. Now, I know that this cat had other ringworm lesions, kind of a classic and fluorescent in the woods lamp, but I was really curious to see if that black gunk was full of hyphae, and it was. Just simple diff-quick, kind of cool. Here's our typical dermatophyte lesion. Again, we've got these funky margins. There's no way the cat made the lesion, so we'd be thinking about ringworm bacteria, and I'd still do a scraping for Demodex, even though it'd be less likely, and that would be Demodex cati, okay, follicular mite. And here we've got dermatophyte that's much more severe, and these lesions are really quite elegant because they look very similar to the dog picture I showed you last hour with pemphigus. Look at the linearity of these lesions. Okay, this is not typical ringworm by any means, but that's what was going on with this cat. When you see these kind of odd type of lesions, and this is odd, okay, you need to add to your differentials things like drug eruption and autoimmune diseases because these are kind of nasty. And in general, look at the ulcerations that's occurring. Ulcerations usually don't occur with dermatophyte. Okay? And again, the cat didn't make these linear lesions. The cat couldn't have made them. And this was all associated with dermatophyte. Dermatophyte is just the great imposter. Plain and simple, it can do all kinds of weird stuff. I mentioned earlier, bacteria, yeast are perpetuating factors. In the cat, I also add a polyp as a perpetuating factor. A polyp tends to come up with chronic inflammation. And a polyp is different from neoplasia in its pleocellular. It's not one cell gone wild like we have in neoplasia. It's pleocellular. And that's why a polyp is different. But a polyp can act like neoplasia in that they tend to proliferate and grow. And they can be a real mess. In general, polyps tend to cause occlusion of the ear canal, leading to secondary infections. Okay? So the polyp by itself is a huge risk factor, but it's also a perpetuating factor because until you get rid of the polyp, you're not even going to know what the underlying cause actually was in the first place. So big vicious circle when it comes to polyps. Contact reactions, both allergic and irritant. This, again, is where I draw the line and say no more topicals in cats. I will occasionally see contact reactions in dogs. Occasionally. I probably see 10 ear cases a week on average when I'm on clinic, and I'd say maybe one every month or so will be what I believe to be a contact reaction to a topical medication. In cats, it seems like every stinking cat that I see has contact reaction to one or several of the compounds in those ear medications. So I think it's very important not to use topicals anymore. Going back, looking at our differential diagnoses, I tried to separate these into unilateral versus bilateral diseases. And in general, unilateral is going to be neoplastic, foreign body, polyp, trauma. Okay, that all makes pretty good sense. Whereas systemic illness and things from the outside in, from the inside out, allergic and illness and autoimmune are more likely to cause it. And in general, ectoparasites are going to be bilateral. Just in general. I've seen occasionally where you just find ear mites in one ear only, but that's fairly uncommon. Here's a cat with some ticks in its ears. Again, luckily, relatively uncommon, pretty nasty, actually. Dermatophyte can do whatever it wants. Bacteria, yeast infection, it's all kind of beating the same stuff to death. So what it really comes down to is that you need to look at all aspects, primary diseases or perpetuating causes, and then the primary causes and predisposing. And you've got to think about each of those every single time you see a cat with otitis. Okay, it's more than getting rid of the yeast. The real question is, why is the yeast there in the first place? And that's your job. This is a picture that Dr. John August gave to me, and it was a case that we saw together on the feline service at Texas A&M. And you can see this polyp, it's just climbing right out of the ear. It's kind of hard to miss. You didn't even need an otoscope. It was just sitting right there. And this one was really kind of a cool case. I'm going to talk about surgery in just a moment, but I'm not a surgeon, but I love the surgeons at A&M. And at the time, Harry Booth was there, who's now at Auburn. And I went down because I wanted to get some extra pictures of this polyp. And I said, so Harry, what are you going to do about this? And he says, watch this. He reaches into his pocket, grabs a hemostat, reaches into the ear. The cat was already anesthetized, by the way. Grabs a polyp and just yanks it out. And I thought the technician was going to pass out. You know, it's just boom. And I'm going, what in the hell did you just do? And he says, well, we already looked in the back of the soft palate. It wasn't there. There's no need to do a CT. Chances are it's in the lateral wall. All you got to do is go in and have a look. So what he did is, with the otoscope, you could go down and you could see that the polyp extended deeper. It was in the bulla. So in surgery, he made an incision down here, made a tiny incision, went into the bulla, scraped the base of the polyp out of the bulla and closed it. Done. Just like that. It was amazing. I'd never seen anything like that. But in general, most polyps are going to originate in the back of the oropharynx. So what you can do is you could, when the cat's anesthetized, get a little spay hook and kind of flip that soft palate and have a look up there. If you're really fancy, you could use a little endoscope or whatever. Or you just take your little finger and reach up there and see if you could palpate it. Most polyps are going to originate in the back of the soft palate and extend all the way through, come up the eustachian tube, through the tympanic membrane, and out the ear canal. So polyps are a pretty cool little beast, and that's just one way to approach them. So in general, history, be careful with your otoscope. Do it when you need it. Culture and susceptibility, really, really important when we're talking about meningotomy, which we're going to get to in just a moment. This is Kashka, the cat that I showed you at the onset. Kashka had a very, very severe sebaceous adenocarcinoma. And this is her CAT scan. And this is her good ear. This is a tympanic bulla, which has two chambers. The tympanic membrane would be right about here. And this is black. This is air-filled. And you could follow up all the way through her ear canal. Spotless, textbook, exactly what we want to see. Here's her ear canal here. Somewhat, and boom, all of this is all neoplasia. All of this. The reason that we did a CT on Kashka is that if she had lytic lesions of her skull, she was to be euthanized. If she didn't, the owner agreed to have the lesion resected to the best of the surgeon's ability, followed by radiation therapy, knowing that it's still a grave prognosis. But that's what the owner elected to do. But a CAT scan is a very, very useful diagnostic tool. Now, I got into a small argument with a radiologist that was visiting one of my seminars, and she contended that if you're going to do this, you should do an MRI, because with the MRI, you're going to get much more useful data than you will from a CT. Well, my argument is it takes about 5 minutes to get a CT. It takes about 3 hours to do an MRI. It costs $180 at Auburn to do a CT. It costs upwards of $300 plus anesthesia for MRI. I'm going to do a CT. Okay? What I'm looking for with the CT is whether or not we've got lytic lesions, and I'm also looking to see what's going on within the bulla. For those of you that are still trying to take skull radiographs of the bulla, the open mouth, just forget it. Ship them off somewhere, get a CT. Open mouth shots of the bulla are incredibly difficult to get. They're labor intensive, they're time consuming, and even with the best intent, you end up with crap. So go ahead and ship these off and get a CT when you suspect middle ear disease. For these cats in general, CBC serum chem thyroid, if indicated in an older cat, but not routinely, FIV, FELV, again, just kind of cover everything. The CT is very, very useful. I don't do plain skull films looking at the ears anymore. It's just not worth it. You just don't get enough bang for your buck. And then biopsy and histopathology, clearly, because it's going to give us our prognosis. When it comes to cleaning ears, there's one thing to use for a cat, and that is saline. I do not use anything else for cleaning ears. Now, for a dog, when I have a dog anesthetized, I am going to use tap water. Why? It's good enough for them, okay? Dogs tolerate this much, much better. In a cat, they are so susceptible to anything you do when you manipulate those ears, I am going to spend the extra 50 cents and use saline. It's just the better way to go, in my opinion. Now, any time you do clean a cat's ear for any reason, usually they're going to be anesthetized. When you're done, I would strongly recommend doing something anti-inflammatory. Give that cat some methylpred orally. I probably wouldn't give an injection unless you absolutely had to, because the mechanism of action of onset between the oral and the injection is exactly the same for steroids anyhow. So you're not going to be any faster with that. But I would give the cat some pred. In fact, many of these cats, if I know I'm dealing with an inflammatory process, oftentimes I'll medicate them with methyl pred before we even do the anesthesia and the ear cleaning, so we get some steroids on board. Because again, just the trauma of cleaning that ear is probably enough to set up some pretty severe inflammation that might not even be there. So I do like getting some steroids on board as soon as possible. In the dog, when I spend all my time and energy cleaning and flushing an ear that just looks awful, okay, and you've all seen them, you get all that gunk out of there and everybody's really happy, and now you've got a wet ear from tissue maceration, from all the moisture you put in, what are you going to do about it? Well, at that point, what I like is to use a drying agent and astringent. There's a product called Burr-Odic with hydrocortisone, and I like to use that immediately after I treat a dog's ear. The other one is HB101, which is steroid, it's hydrocortisone, and also the astringent agent, boric acid. Okay, so HB101 or Burr-Odic, both suitable right after you clean a dog's ear, but I'm not going to put anything topical into that cat's ear, okay? Not at that point after cleaning. So again, big bias, big differences as you approach these cases. By the way, my own personal favorite ear product for dogs is Epi-Odic, just for maintenance and routine cleaning at home. It's just a product that I really like. I think they've done a good job with the formulation. There's a lot of good ones out there, but I've just developed my own bias. Yes? Okay. The question is, when you get the cats that come in, they're usually young, ear mites, tons of gunk, am I cleaning them? The answer is no. We're going to talk about our antiparasitic agents. Might even be the next slide. Nope, coming up in a minute. In just a moment. But the products that we now have available for treating ear mites have gotten so good, I leave them alone. When I graduated in 1989 and was in practice, my routine thing was to take these cats and sedate them and thoroughly flush out all that gunk. And the treatment of choice at that time was Tresiderm. And after finding out that I sloughed many cats' ear pinnas and they got worse and worse because of the Tresiderm, that's where I started learning my clinical bias of not using topicals. But nowadays, with Selamectin and Acarex and Milbemite, my God, those products are so excellent. Just leave them alone. Now, you know, there's pros and cons to cleaning them and to not cleaning them. But usually what you have in those ears are a lot of dried blood and crusts. My analogy, and I know this is kind of gross, but if you get a crust on your arm, a scab, if you will, and you decide to just peel it off, Okay? It's going to hurt like hell. Your body's trying to heal that lesion. And for the most part, I think you have a certain amount of healing that's occurring in these ear mite cases where you have all that dried blood and exudate. And if you go in and just remove all that gunk, you might not really be doing the cat that big of a favor. That's my take on it. Do you routinely clean them? Usually just once. And what do you use as your preferred product for cleaning the cats with really bad ear mites? Of what? Epiotic? Okay. Anybody else have comments regarding that? I think it's an excellent point of discussion. And again, there's no right and wrong answer. You need to find what works best for you. Yes? What about using mineral oil? Mineral oil is very, very occlusive and can be irritating to the tympanic membrane. So anytime you put anything oily into the ear, you have to remove it. There's an excellent product that I use for dog ears called Clear-X, and it's really, really greasy, but boy, does that stuff break down the gunk. And even though it says on the bottle not to be used if there's a ruptured eardrum, most of the time I don't even know if there's a ruptured eardrum until you clean the junk out. So I use it, okay? But the thing about Clear-X is once you put it in, you've got to lavage it out. If you leave it in the ear canal, you are going to develop so much irritation afterwards, it's not even funny. So you got to be careful with oily substances and leaving them in, because eventually what will happen is it will migrate to the tympanic membrane and sit on that eardrum and cause inflammation and irritation. So going back to my bias, point number one was that dogs and cats are indeed different. I truly believe that cats are predisposed to contact reactions, both irritant and true allergic contact dermatitis. I think they develop both. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to discern the two based on histopathology alone. You kind of look at it and say, yep, that sure as heck looks like an inflammatory reaction to my topical, and you stop. And it really doesn't matter at that point whether it's irritant or true allergic contact, except that a true allergic contact reaction is going to persist for a much longer period of time once you withdraw it. My reminder, I'm glad I put it up there, cats are very susceptible to ototoxicity with iodine. And I know that there are several practitioners out there that will use dilute povidine iodine scrub as a flushing agent when they're cleaning dogs' ears. Just a couple things. First of all, iodine by itself breaks down very, very rapidly in exudation. And most of the ears that you're cleaning out are highly exudative. The iodine's not doing squat anyhow. But in cats, they're very, very susceptible to ototoxicity. Ototoxicity is deafness, and in most cases, it's permanent deafness. So one more reason, you don't need to do it. You have other options. Don't use iodine. It's just not an appropriate product for dogs or cats. This is a good one, too. Cats hate topicals. Have you ever tried to medicate your own cat's ears with a topical? If you think treating dogs is bad, wait till you try to treat a cat. And to try to hold the pinnas down so the medication goes down the ears, forget it. First thing they do is shake, and then they're pawing and licking and rubbing and swallowing all this crap. It's just not worth it. And I think owners get hurt. There's a risk of injury to the owners. Plenty of reasons to stop using topicals in cats, in my humble opinion. That'll be the day. Anyhow, for topicals, ear mites in cats, Otomite Plus, pyrethrin drops, still one of the cheapest products to use for treating ear mites. And some of you may be in a situation where somebody comes in and says, I've got 50 barn cats and they all have ear mites. What can we do about it? And you say, well, let's just put them on selamectin at $12 a cat. And while they're finishing laughing, you say, well, for 12 bucks, I could sell you a bottle of Paramite or Otomite Plus and you could treat them if you wish. I would prefer not to use it because it's a topical that goes into the ear. My treatment of choice is selamectin, Revolution. It is darn near 100% effective for ear mites and for scabies. And in cats, for ear mites, I will use this every 2 weeks for 3 treatments. The package says once a month. The package says once a month. I don't believe it. I use that extra dosage. It's one extra dosage. It's not going to make or break the client. But I believe it makes a difference. Typical lifespan of ear mites from egg to adult producing another egg on average is about 21 days. So the possibility is if you miss that window of opportunity, the selamectin might not be effective. The argument is it's an ivermectin drug and it has great residual activity. It's probably going to get the job done. But for one extra dosage, it's not going to cost the clients very much. And I know that when I treat with this product every 2 weeks for three treatments, and it's the same way I treat for scabies, it's going to work, period. It's that good. Ivermectin. I do not use injectable ivermectin or oral ivermectin in cats. I don't use it. I have seen horror stories. I've also heard, well, Dr. Harada still lives in Honolulu, but the Honolulu Humane Society, Hawaii Humane Society, would routinely treat these cats with ivermectin, and their incidence of adverse reactions was very small. Well, very small. What does that mean? Well, for a feral cat or a stray cat that comes in, yeah, if you lose a few to ivermectin, who cares? But when it's your client's pet and you have an adverse reaction and you kick one off with ivermectin, I'm just not going to do it. I think we've got other drugs licensed and approved. It's up to you. But I'm tired of going way out of my way to save my client's money when there's potential risk to the patient. And that's my concern. Okay? We do have this product, Acarex. It is licensed and approved for use in the cat. It's 0.01%. which is very, very dilute. This product does go into the ear. The package says one dosage, 100% cure. It also says you might need to come back and retreat a second time. This is a drug that needs to go into the cat's ears. I'm going to go with selumectin, and I put it back in the shoulder blades, nothing in the ears. Okay? There's also milbamycin. It's a great product, but you have to put it into the ears. Use your judgment, okay? My argument is I'm using selumectin, I'm dribbling it on the back of the cat, and I know it's going to work, but you've got all these options. You have to do what works best for you. I know this is kind of hokey, but I want to take a quick straw poll here. What I want you to do is we're going to go through two of these. I want to know who's using milbamite, and I want to know who's using the Acarex is their preferred therapy. So if you prefer milbamite, please raise your hand. Very small percentage. Okay, and Acarex? Huge majority. Okay, so you raised your hand for milbamite. Are you happy with milbamite? Is it working? Yes. Anybody else want to make a comment about milbamite? Cost-wise, they're about the same, correct? About the same, roughly? Okay, so next question is, for those of you folks that are using the Acarex, are you using a second dosage, yes or no? If you're using second dosage, please raise your hand, because I see heads going both ways. Okay, just a few. Is it because you're not getting adequate treatment the first go-around? Or you're just doing it routinely to cover your butt? Okay, I don't have a problem with that, because you know you're going to get the job done with that second dosage. Hopefully the rest of you are using selumectin or some other combination of this junk, whatever fits your needs. But again, as veterinarians, you got to go out there and make tough decisions every day within the parameters and guidelines of your clients and within the boundaries of what you believe to be best for their patient as healthcare. This is another picture that Dr. John August gave to me. And this was really quite lovely. This is a cat that presented with a very subtle head tilt. On physical examination, there was nothing wrong with the cat. We decided that otitis media all by itself was a good differential diagnosis. So we sedated and anesthetized the cat for CT and otoscopic exam with the idea that if we needed to, we're going to go ahead and perform the meningotomy. Now, in this case, the cat had no evidence of otitis externa. Look at this ear canal. This is spotless. What we are looking at here is the tympanic membrane. This is the eardrum right here, and we see these round things right here. What are these round things that we're looking at? Gas bubbles, correct. These are gas bubbles. This is fluid behind the tympanic membrane in that tympanic bulla. This happens to cats very frequently. The eardrum is not ruptured, and the cats present with subtle signs, maybe intense pruritus even of the ear, but no overt otitis externa. This is also very common in small children to have this kind of problem. Kids with recurrent ear disease tend to get middle ear disease like this. So at this point, the idea is that we need to perform a meningotomy. A meningotomy is a big expensive word that means we're going to put a hole in the eardrum and collect a sample. So while the cat is anesthetized, we're going to take a sterile otoscopic cone, and we're going to insert the cone, and you need more hands than you have, so you need good technicians to help you on this. And while that cone is in place, you are going to take a spinal needle and pass it through the sterile cone and puncture through the eardrum. You will feel a pop, and you're going to be scared the first time it happens. And again, this is one of those times where the next time you got a dog for euthanasia and necropsy, maybe you ought to think about practicing one so you feel what it's like to go through a normal eardrum. But you pop it through, and then you attach a syringe and you withdraw fluid. And the fluid that you have, you now submit for culture, and you can do your own cytologies. But that's now a beautiful sample to submit for culture. Yes? Oh, never chlorhexidine. The question is, some of these cats will present with otitis externa as well as this type of situation with the otitis media intact eardrum. What do you do? Anesthesia, lavage the hell out of them with saline, okay? And I'm probably not going to go any further beyond that. I'm going to remove as much gunk so that when I do insert the cone, for the most part, what's going to happen is you're going to kind of push everything down, pull it out, take another cone, do it again until you got pretty much of a clear shot. It's not going to be a perfect situation at that point, but the idea of using a sterile cone is really the biggest difference. And that is just an excellent question. Chlorhexidine in general is highly ototoxic to dogs and cats, which is why we have no licensed and approved products that contain chlorhexidine for the ear. Never, ever, ever put it in the ear. I've been involved in lawsuits where veterinarians with good intention have inserted chlorhexidine to clean the ears of dogs or cats, and they've come up stone deaf one time, one application. Please be careful with that. But there really is no good way. Now, in the dog, I might be a little more diligent in cleaning. I might consider possibly using an iodine-based solution. I'm not going to use any kind of alcohol because alcohols are going to cause a lot of irritation, inflammation. And clearly, hydrogen peroxide is not worth a flip anyhow, so we wouldn't do that. So anyhow, going back to this case, we collected our sample, and just in general, you are going to have staph infections, Pasteurella. In general, those are kind of the biggies. We'll also get some anaerobes that might be hiding in these cultures. I do like to culture them. But if you see a case like this and you don't want to do a meningotomy, empirically, Clavamox or clindamycin. Give it a couple weeks and reassess. Those are my empiric drug choices for cats with middle ear disease. I would not use a topical, but I would try this empirically. If the client says, let's get an answer, I would much prefer to do the meningotomy. In the literature, and the question always comes up, when you rupture an eardrum, how long does it take to heal? The only publications that are out there were on normal, healthy beagle dogs where the tympanic membrane was ruptured, and it took 21 to 30 days, roughly, for that lesion to heal back in normal beagle dogs. Now, that may not be anything typical of the cases that you see where these dogs are a mess. So, in general, when I see a dog with a ruptured ear canal, ruptured eardrum, and there's nothing there but a little flap and remnants, the likelihood of that growing back is minimal. Most dogs do very well without an eardrum. In this particular situation, I would tell the client that it's very likely that the eardrum will indeed heal up afterwards. And by putting that hole in there, we're going to relieve all that pressure. People that have had this procedure performed, in children, they talk about putting tubes in their ears. Okay, that's exactly what they're doing. They're doing a long-term meningotomy to relieve that pressure and get that gunk out of there. So this cat has a very good prognosis, but we got to get the right drugs on board for it. If by some chance you end up with a yeast otitis in the cat, I use itraconazole. Problem with itraconazole is that most cats become anorexic after 3 or 4 days of being on itraconazole. Anorectic cats are not good. So usually I go back and follow up, and most of the yeast are gone anyhow, so I might stop therapy when the cat develops anorexia. Excuse me. As I mentioned earlier today, if you were here for the first session, Diflucan, fluconazole, has now become one of our cheapest antifungal agents available to us. The next time I see one of these cat cases full of yeast, I'm going to use fluconazole. 10 mg per kg, or roughly 50 milligrams per cat, once a day. Fluconazole used to be $19 a tablet. It's now about $1.29. The cost has just gone down to nothing now that it's available as generic. I would strongly encourage you to start using fluconazole and get a feel clinically whether or not it's a drug that you're going to continue to use or whether or not you don't like it. I know this drug will work to get rid of the yeast in the cat otitis. I do not use topicals. Yes? How many days? For most cases, I would try to get 14 days. That should whack most yeast infections in a cat's ear. But, again, sometimes on Sporinox, they get anorectic after 3 or 4 days, and you ask them to come back in just to make sure you're not missing anything with the cat and make sure they're not icteric. And you do your cytology and find that all the yeast are gone anyhow. It's always amazing. Same thing is true when you use ketoconazole for dogs. I've had student cases where the dogs would just be loaded with yeast, and we start the dog on ketoconazole, and I'll tell the student, hey, just bring the dog back in a couple days. Let's do our samples again. You can't find the yeast. Ketoconazole is so good against Malassezia, it's not even funny. There's a question in the back. Yes? Do I flush out the middle ear at the time of doing the meningotomy? Going back to this image. No, I do not. Okay. Relieving the pressure and sucking out most of that fluid is usually adequate. Part of the problem with quote-unquote lavaging it is that you could do a lot of harm by injecting things in there. And unless you had a huge incision, you know, we're talking about 16, 18-gauge spinal needle. It's a pretty small opening. Most of the time, the fluid that comes out of here is quite watery, and you could remove a fair amount of it. It's not mucoid in general. And even if it was mucoid, you know, trying to squirt in and flush out and stuff, you're going to move around, probably do more damage to the tympanic membrane than you need to. If you think you could get away with it, go for it. But I probably wouldn't inject anything into there like an antibiotic or anything like that. I tend to just leave them alone. It's a good question. Yes? Is the incision made on the ventral part of the tympanic membrane? If you can, the reality is you just go in, take your best shot. Okay, and just in general, with the way the otoscope goes in and the angle and stuff, you're going to end up more ventral than anything. And even if you were a little bit aggressive and you went too deep, you're going to be going into the bone of the bulla anyhow. You're not going to be going into the oval window. Okay, so you don't have to worry about that. But again, practice it. Just do it on a couple of cadavers, and again, all of a sudden you're an expert. You shouldn't be afraid of this procedure. It's a great diagnostic tool. Yes? How am I getting my cytologies? Usually externally. I try not to go into the ear canal unless I absolutely have to. Sometimes we have to, knowing that there will be some risk. I guess really where it comes back to, and that's a great question, is the fact that for routine cases, if you don't have to stick a swab into a cat's ear, don't do it. But if you have to, you have to. Just be careful with it. Okay? How's that for covering my butt? Yes? For the most part, those are going to Mother Nature will take care of those for you. You disagree? Okay. I guess I've just not experienced enough of that to see that's not the kind of stuff that comes in on a referral basis. You're going to have to use your judgment on that one. If you think you need to remove it, remove it. I've done ear cleanings on dogs that were so bad you had to use the ear curettes and physically scrape the bulla to get these concretions of wax and bacteria and stuff out. I hate to do it, but sometimes you have to do it.
I've had cats that have been there for years.
Does it even... Yeah, but if it doesn't even bother them, why should it bother you?
No, this thing is packed full of
Okay. 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 We've got 30 seconds here. This is Kashka's ear after surgery. This was our cat with the sebaceous adenocarcinoma. And you can see, look how her entire pinna was full of tumor. This is all neoplastic going down into her ear canal. So one of the good things about her surgery is that we're able to debulk, and sometimes you might be lucky and actually remove the cause of the problem, but there's going to be some cosmetic defects. Postoperatively, we always worry about long-term infection, draining tracts, and Horner syndrome associated with facial nerve damage, and it's the close-up of Kashka's eye once again. So we are on time, and I appreciate your attention and wonderful questions. Again, I consider this to be very controversial. I don't have the answers, but I do have some opinions. Thank you all for the morning session, and hopefully you folks will come back for the afternoon and join me again. And please, please fill out your evaluation cards. I really appreciate it, and have a great lunch. Bye.